Hello. Oh, welcome to the SBF Japan News Group podcast channel. I am Murata, Director and Senior Program Officer of the Japan News Program at the Sasaka Peace Foundation in Tokyo. Today, we have distinguished American security experts, Dr. Hovland and Dr. Zach Cooper. So they will discuss about challenges facing the West and Japan in 2024, Russia-Ukraine war, Middle East, China, and U.S. presidential election. So Dr. Hovland is the Henry Kissinger Distinguished Professor of Global Affairs at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He is also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and an expert on American defense policy, grand strategy, and history. He is the author or editor of several books, including most recently, The Twilight Struggle, What the Cold War Teaches Us About Great Power Rivalry, and Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. The Danger Zone was also translated into Japanese last year. Another guest, Dr. Zach Cooper. He is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies U.S. strategy in Asia, including alliance dynamics and U.S.-China competition. He has authored a variety of studies on Asia, on topics including U.S. military strategy and posture in Asia, Chinese coercion, and U.S. defense cooperation with regional allies and partners. He is also the co-editor of two books, Post-War Japan, World Security and Uncertainty since 1945, and Strategic Japan, New Approaches to Foreign Policy and the U.S.-Japan Alliance. So in August last year, Dr. Blount and Dr. Cooper visited Japan with our program and had many discussions about current security issues in the Indo-Pacific region, including U.S.-China relations and the Japan-U.S. alliance with various Japanese experts. It's been a little while, but in this episode, I hope that you will be able to explore today's discussion based on that experience of the trip to and move forward into thinking about the most updated international security environment. About the topic, since the beginning of the Biden administration, the U.S. has faced a lot of security challenges around the world. Russian invasion of Ukraine, Israel-Hamas war, and growing rivalry with China. Taiwan's presidential election was just held last weekend. And importantly, this year, the U.S. will have presidential election. We have just seen the former president, Mr. Trump, won at the Republican caucus in Iowa. And domestic politics might have huge impact on not only American foreign policy itself, but also on Indo-Pacific region and the Japan-U.S. alliance as well, we expect. So in this environment, there are so many things going on, including many which we did not expect a couple of years ago, or even when you visited Japan last year. So how will these dynamics affect American strategy? Can the U.S. forces focus on the competition with China while facing the challenges in other regions? What would be the impact on U.S. diplomacy if Trump were to become president again? And how international order will be changed in coming years, and what is the role of U.S.-Japan alliance under these circumstances? So these are quite many questions we would like to ask, but we believe Dr. Blount and Dr. Cooper are perfect experts to discuss these topics as we think about 2024 and beyond. So I very much look forward to the very open and thought-provoking discussion. So, Hao and Zach, thank you very much for joining us today, and welcome back to the SBF program. Zach, maybe you please kindly start the discussion, and time after this is yours.
Wonderful. Well, thanks, Aya. It's wonderful to see you again. And I know Hao and I are both really appreciative of the chance to work with Sasakawa Peace Foundation and work with you over many years and really learned a lot on our trip to Japan at the end of last year. So Hao, I thought I might start with a big picture question, which is 2024, what do we have ahead of us? It has gone off, unfortunately, with a bang. We had an election just a few days ago in Taiwan. We're all watching that pretty closely, but at the same time, we're seeing challenges around the rest of the world, right? In Yemen, we're now seeing the Houthis directly attack U.S. forces and the U.S. respond. We're seeing the continuation of the war in Ukraine, the Israel-Gaza conflict, land grabs by Venezuela, Azerbaijan, much more. And the world sort of seems like it's on fire. You wrote a piece that I liked just a few weeks ago entitled "Biden's Foreign Policy Had a Rough 2023 and 2024 Looks Even Rougher." So optimistic of you. But where do you think we're headed over the next year?
Well, remember that you can yell at authors about content and you can yell at editors about titles. So unfortunately, I don't always get to pick the titles of my piece. But it's great to be here with you, and just want to reiterate your thanks to Aya and SPF and the whole team there for all they have done to strengthen U.S.-Japan relations over a number of years. And I've greatly enjoyed my interactions with them. So to pick up your question, I think the reality is that 2024 is going to see serious instability and potentially violence in all three of the key theaters of Eurasia, overlaid across the geopolitical instability that will be created by a number of key elections, not least that in the United States in November. And so if we just sort of work our way from west to east, starting in Eastern Europe, you have a war between Russia and Ukraine that might best be characterized as a dynamic stalemate, in the sense that it's stalemated because the front lines aren't moving much, but it's dynamic in the sense that both sides are trying to build advantage through this year and beyond because they have not yet achieved their goals. And so the fact that the front lines are stationary now doesn't mean that they will remain so. And the reality is that if the West is not successful in providing Ukraine with significant further amounts of aid, we could see Ukraine's position erode pretty significantly there. If you work your way down into the Middle East, you really do have a region that is aflame. Obviously, you have the war between Israel and Hamas that is centered in Gaza, but there is threat of escalation. Indeed, there is violence on at least four other fronts. There's the West Bank, where you have significant tensions between Israeli settlers and the Palestinian population. There's the northern border with Lebanon, where tensions between Israel and Hezbollah are quite high, and a number of observers think we may be heading for a significantly increased state of tension, perhaps conflict there later this year. You have sort of the Iraq-Syria theater, where Iranian proxies are doing battle with U.S. forces, and we've seen recently ballistic missile strikes by Iran itself into both of those countries in the past couple of days. And then most notably, you have the Red Sea theater, where the Houthis have been launching a pretty steady drumbeat of attacks upon maritime traffic and even upon U.S. and allied warships. And so I think the takeaway here is that even after the most tense phase, the war in Gaza, dies down, you're going to have a significantly elevated level of tensions in that region for many months to come. The one that has been quiet by comparison recently is the Western Pacific. U.S.-China relations, at least optically, have been a decent place since Biden and Xi met in November. But as you mentioned, we had an election in Taiwan last weekend. The winner was William Lai. His DPP is in control of Taiwan's presidency for the third straight time. That's the first time that's happened in Taiwan's democratic era. China really does not like Mr. Lai. It views him as a separatist and a pro-independence rabble-rouser. It really has a problem in the sense that the center of gravity in Taiwanese politics appears to be shifting away from Beijing's preferred interlocutor, which would be the KMT, and towards the DPP. And so I think the smart money is betting that Beijing will find some way of demonstrating its displeasure with this outcome, whether by increasing the diplomatic pressure on Taiwan, perhaps turning the economic screws a little bit, or perhaps engaging in another round of aggressive military exercises of the sort we last saw in August 2022 after Nancy Pelosi's visit. And then on top of all that, of course, you have the U.S. presidential election. We can talk in more detail about former President Trump, President Biden, their respective positions, and what that might mean for the future. But the reality is that that election is already influencing the choices of countries around the world. And so the prospect that President Trump might return to office, for instance, is surely giving Vladimir Putin hope that he can win the war in Ukraine if he just hangs on long enough for the Western coalition to fracture. And that's just one of many ways in which the election is already influencing global affairs.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess the big concern coming out of all of that is that you have a Biden team, which I think came into office really wanting to focus on the China challenge. And, you know, if we're candid, I'd say they've done pretty well, right? Especially given the hand they were dealt. But what you're laying out is a world in which the challenges they face in the Middle East and in Europe are really urgent challenges, right? The Ukraine war, Israel, Gaza, attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, and they demand attention. And the challenges in Asia are, as they always are, long-term and slightly less urgent. And, you know, maybe we'll get back to a place where they are urgent, you know, Taiwan Strait crisis, something happening at Second Thomas Shoal in the South China Sea. Korea experts have just written that they think Kim Jong-un is preparing to wage war on the Korean Peninsula. So it's not that we couldn't have a real crisis in Asia, but the European theater, the Middle Eastern theater, seems to be dragging American time and attention back, as they always do. And at the same time, as you're noting, I guess I worry that the U.S. domestic focus over the next year is going to just increase, right? We're going to be talking about our own elections. I think we're going to be talking a lot about border security. And it makes me wonder how much time will be left for the big picture strategic thinking that the Biden team wanted to do when it comes to Asia and China in particular. So one good test of this, I think, will be when Prime Minister Kishida comes to Washington, which sounds like it's going to be March or April. And, you know, I think they will want to demonstrate some sustained attention on Asia and on Japan in particular. But it's kind of hard to do that in a year when the president is probably not going to travel to Asia, right? It doesn't seem likely that he's going to get to the region, at least before the November 2024 election. So I guess I sort of worry that their attention is going to be pretty divided over the next year, and it's going to make it really hard to actually execute a long-term strategy of the kind they've put forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in some ways, you know, we should be fair to the Biden team, as I know you are, and saying that despite the pull of other crises around the world, they have managed to do some pretty impressive stuff on coalition building, especially in the Indo-Pacific. If you look at the changes to the U.S.-Japan alliance over the past couple of years, if you look at the movement on the Quad and AUKUS and the ROK Japan-U.S. Trilat, and you could mention five other bilateral or multilateral relationships that have been improved in significant ways. And so in that sense, the distraction critique doesn't bite as hard as you might think, but it is real in two other ways. One is attention from high-level officials. And I think you hit the nail on the head here. If Tony Blinken is headed to the Middle East for the eighth time in the past 3 months, he's not going to be headed to Japan or the Philippines or some other important place in the Indo-Pacific. And then the other one is on resources. And so just, you know, a couple of examples that have been in the news. The U.S. is getting stretched really thin on missile defenses. We need a lot of them in the Middle East, where we're burning through a lot of them trying to protect our troops, trying to protect shipping in the Red Sea. But we also need them in Ukraine to help protect Ukrainian cities. And we're going to need a ton of them in the Indo-Pacific if you move into a crisis or conflict situation with China. Or if you look at long-range precision strike, right? The U.S. Navy launched 80 Tomahawk missiles against targets in Yemen over the weekend, or I guess late last week. That is a non-trivial chunk of the Navy's annual production of Tomahawk missiles. And so it kind of points up the weaknesses of the U.S. defense industrial base and how those become more pronounced as you're looking at crises across multiple theaters.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let's zero in a little bit on the China challenge before we jump back to American domestic politics, which I know is everyone's favorite topic. So we've written a little bit together about China and strategy, and both of us have thought independently a lot about it. I think the big question is, in 2024, what's the US-China relationship going to look like? You can make two different arguments. One is, hey, we just came out of this San Francisco summit and things seem to be more stable than they've been in, let's say, the last 3 years, right? We're seeing engagements at all levels, State Department, Treasury, Commerce, and even on the defense side, finally, we're seeing some movement. Just last week, they had the defense policy coordination talks. They're having the military maritime talks as well. And then the Secretary of Defense seems likely to see his new counterpart at Shangri-La later this year. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs just talked to his counterpart. So we're seeing a lot of activity going on between the US and China. And you could sort of make the argument that, look, things seem to be better than they've been in the US-China relationship, at least since the beginning of the Biden administration. On the other hand, you could make the exact opposite argument pretty easily, right? Which is, as you said, like Qingda just won election. The Chinese are not particularly happy with him. They have already stolen one of Taiwan's allies in just the last few days. They seem likely to continue putting pressure on the Philippines at Second Thomas Shoal. They also are walking into a period in terms of the US election where clearly American political leaders are going to be saying and doing things on China that Beijing will not appreciate. So the first question is, where do you see US-China ties going in the next year? Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I want you to weigh in on this as well. I'm a little bit more pessimistic. I think that we are likely to look back on the spirit of San Francisco, or whatever you want to call the atmosphere that emerged from the Xi Biden meeting in November, more as a high point in the relationship rather than sort of a new floor on top of which you build. It was no small thing to have that meeting come off after the Pelosi crisis, after Balloon Gate, and all of the other disruptions to the relationship. And the administration worked very hard to bring this about with a number of high-level visits to Beijing. They got the meeting without giving up a whole lot to get it. And I think that that's worth noting here. The challenge is that, you know, leaving aside the balloon, 2023 was fairly propitious for US-China diplomacy because there wasn't, you know, really an obvious irritant in the relationship during 2023. And in fact, Beijing had a pretty strong incentive to play it cool on cross-strait issues, lest they spook the Taiwanese population and, you know, deliver a landslide victory to the DPP. Obviously, that consideration no longer pertains. They've got another DPP president that they're going to have to deal with, and it's somebody that they don't particularly like. And so now you're going to have cross-strait issues come back to the forefront of the relationship. And that, I think, is the single biggest irritant in the relationship, because from a Chinese perspective, U.S. policy toward Taiwan is the biggest gripe they have, because they think the U.S. is slowly but surely walking away from its one China policy. And Taiwan is in some ways the most sensitive issue from an American perspective, because it's the place where Americans think that Chinese aggression is most likely, and it's increasingly taking on the role, a central strategic role in American posture in the Western Pacific. So I worry that we're headed for higher tensions as well. And then the last point I'll make here is that notwithstanding some comments from U.S. officials, the reality is that the military balance gets worse and worse from a U.S. perspective every year in the Western Pacific. The military balance in 2024 is worse than the military balance was in August 2022. The military balance in August 2022 is worse than the military balance was in August 2020, and so on and so forth. And so what that means is, as long as this trend continues, every time an irritant pops up, Beijing has more and better options for expressing its displeasure. And so we shouldn't be shocked if, whether it's this year or next year, we see Beijing go a little bit farther in expressing that displeasure, because the correlation of forces, so to speak, is more advantageous.
Yeah,
where do you come down on this, Zach?
Yeah, I think a couple of questions about how the Chinese are looking at things. So one is, you mentioned Lai Ching-te's victory. You know, he gave a victory speech, which I thought was quite careful, much more so than I believe the Chinese expected him to be. I'm sure that that speech and the language he used had been previewed to U.S. officials beforehand. So one issue is, I think it's possible that the DPP will be much more cautious than the Chinese believe in how they handle cross-strait issues. And Bi Kim-shiao, who's going to be the vice president in Taiwan, knows the U.S. and American positions extremely well, and she will be able to interpret them carefully in Taipei. And I think it's possible that Taiwan issues will be a little bit less fraught than people imagined as a result. And also the fact is that, you know, the KMT could very well end up in control of the legislature, the legislative yuan, depending on what the third party leader, Ko-en-je, decides to do and where he aligns his eight legislators. So there's sort of an argument for the Chinese that, hey, all is not lost, right? So on Taiwan, I think we've got to wait and see exactly what happens and how the Chinese read it. The two other issues that really worry me, one is Philippines. I am of the view that we are in a really difficult position now in the South China Sea. The United States is supporting the Philippines at this shoal called Second Thomas Shoal, where the ship called the Sierra Madre is beached. The Filipinos are trying to resupply this ship, and the Chinese are trying to stop that from happening. And I think we're getting really close to ship collisions that could eventually lead to a sinking of a Philippine ship. And you know, there is a U.S.-Philippines mutual defense treaty, which would be invoked if the Chinese sunk a Filipino public vessel. And that is certainly not out of the realm of possibility. And it's not clear how Manila or Beijing are going to get out of the situation without having some major crisis. So I think that's one that we've got to pay really close attention to. And then the other, which you've written a lot about, is what happens with China's economy. I just got back from China, and I have to say the economy seemed worse than I expected it. And people seemed more concerned about the economy than I thought they would be. So I wonder how that will shift Chinese views. Now, obviously, you've written a whole book on this. So, and it's translated into Japanese, so people can go read it if they're in Japan. But I think the way the Chinese react to that slowing economy is going to be really critical over the next year.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I would just, I'll add on the South China Sea issue. You know, the Sierra Madre is almost the perfect example of the sort of alliance commitment that people who worry about entrapment or unwanted conflict would point to. I mean, it's generous to call it a ship. It's sort of like a rusting hulk on a coral reef, and it's constantly at risk of falling apart unless you pour concrete to shore it up, which is a bit of the nub of the dispute between the Philippines and China over these issues. And so it's one of these things where it's become deeply symbolic of the U.S.-Philippines alliance, in part because the U.S. has now promised over a couple of different administrations to treat an attack on Philippines forces in the South China Sea as something that would invoke the U.S.-Philippines mutual defense treaty. But when you actually think about sort of the value of what is involved, it is so low in any concrete term relative to the downside risk of a U.S.-China confrontation, that I think an aggressive Chinese move at Second Thomas Shoal, unless it were so flagrantly egregious as to obviously bring the treaty into play, would actually pose some pretty tough dilemmas for the Biden administration about how to respond.
Yeah, and to date, you know, they've really let the Filipinos take the lead, which I think is probably the right move, but ultimately, if you think that there's going to be a conflict unless we do something there, right? Like if we keep having Chinese and Philippine vessels near each other, shooting water cannons and bumping up against each other, eventually something bad will happen. And so I think this is a really tough one for the United States generally, but also for the Biden team, which wants to be so supportive of especially treaty allies, but has a really hard case here where there's no obvious right answer. And if they stand back and let this happen, the chance of this sort of crisis is I think growing by the day.
The good news is that we have an ally in the Philippines that is A, more committed to the alliance than it had been certainly under Duterte, but also playing this one relatively cool and not behaving in ways that are, you know, designed to deliberately ratchet up tensions and, you know, thrust the US and China into a conflict. And that's no small benefit in an area as fraught as this one.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. Well, why don't we turn to domestic politics? No reason for pessimism here, I'm sure, Hal. But look, we just had the Iowa caucuses. Donald Trump won something like 51% of the vote. And we've seen already a couple of candidates withdraw in the aftermath. We still have Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, and in a few days we'll head to New Hampshire, where, you know, it seems that maybe Nikki Haley has a chance of at least capturing close to 40-45% of the vote. Whether that will happen, whether she can actually beat Trump there is unclear. But at least from my standpoint, what happens after New Hampshire seems pretty unlikely to lead to Donald Trump losing the primary. So on the Republican side, it seems that we're likely to get Donald Trump unless we have some constitutional or other legal issue that prevents him from running for president. And then on the Democratic side, I think the fact that we're likely to have Trump means we're almost certain to have Biden unless one of them has a severe health issue. So it looks like we're doing this all over again because Americans loved the Trump-Biden runoff the first time. What's your take on domestic politics? And then we can get into how it might matter for the US and Japan internationally going forward.
Yeah, this is pretty remarkable. I mean, you're going to have a presidential matchup, assuming it's Trump versus Biden, that the majority of Americans are deeply unenthusiastic about. You know, the majority don't want either of these people to be president. And yet that is what the political system is producing. And so that's maybe thing one to keep in mind. In terms of the role that foreign policy will play in the election, you know, foreign policy almost never decides U.S. presidential elections outside of global war scenarios or World War II scenarios. It does matter, though. I mean, if you look through the exit polling, you'll always find, you know, some number of people, could be 7% of the populace, that say foreign policy was the most important reason in driving their choice. And in an election that could come down to, you know, margins of a few thousand votes in a few key states, that could be pretty significant. I think foreign policy will play a non-trivial role in the election. I think you're going to see the Biden administration make the argument that in a dangerous world, you need a steady hand. And who do you want answering the phone at 3 p.m.? President Biden, whose administration has done this careful crisis management in Ukraine and the Middle East, or President Trump? And they'll show the split screen of, you know, Biden going to Kyiv, Biden going to Israel, and Trump sort of foaming at the mouth in one of his stump speeches. The argument the Trump administration is going to make is going to be sort of typically a little bit incoherent, which is not a disqualifying factor for President Trump. In fact, that's a good thing from his perspective. And it'll go like this. One, the Biden administration has gotten the United States deep into these conflicts in which its interests are limited. So thinking particularly of the Ukraine war here, where President Trump has been critical of the amount of aid the United States has given. But two, that President Biden is just too old, too weak, too feeble, too sleepy to deal with all of the bad folks the United States has to confront in the world. And the subtext, or maybe the main text here, will be, in 2024, the world is on fire. You've got wars in Europe and the Middle East. You've got high tensions in the Western Pacific. And under the Trump administration back in 2019, the world was not on fire. It was less on fire. The Houthis didn't dare attack shipping in the Red Sea to this extent under President Trump. Putin didn't dare to attack Ukraine to the same degree, and so on and so forth. I think that is analytically unfair to the Biden administration, given the hand that it was dealt and given the good work that it has done in a number of these areas. But that doesn't mean it won't resonate with some number of voters who view, you know, foreign policy issues, who think of foreign policy issues kind of as just like a referendum on the state of the world and America's role in it, as opposed to going really deep on particular issues. But Zach, you know the politics of this probably better than I do. So what's your read on how it's going to play during the election, but then more importantly, where we might end up after November 2024?
Well, first, I think you're right that you and I may be the only people in the United States that make votes based on foreign policy. So it's certainly not a huge input into the outcome, but it's definitely a major output. I guess I'm worried that the Biden team doesn't have a clear message here on foreign policy anymore, right? They came in wanting to say, okay, we're going to sort of right-size American efforts in the Middle East. So got out of Afghanistan. They tried to sort of get out of Yemen and not be involved in Saudi Arabia's conflict there. They wanted to get towards some more stable situation with Iran. And they were nervous about Israel. And I mean, what we've seen on those last 3 points is just a complete reversal, right? Now the US is fighting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen against the Houthis, which would have been almost impossible, frankly, to imagine. The Iranians are plowing forward with their nuclear program, and we're in basically an open proxy war with them, which is very far from what Colin Call or others in the administration certainly had planned. And then the US is ending up basically backing the Israelis. And yes, the Biden team is quite unhappy with Israel. But at the end of the day, you know, the US has ended up as the primary backer of Benjamin Netanyahu under the Biden administration. This just seems like a complete reversal of everything one would have expected in the Middle East. In Ukraine, I think you're right that the danger is that if Ukraine had made some real territorial wins in 2023, we'd be having a totally different conversation right now. But it certainly looks like the momentum is with Russia, and it will even go further towards Russia, barring, you know, a heart attack for Vladimir Putin or something of that sort across 2024, even more so if the US doesn't support Ukraine with funding. And then in Asia, I think what you said earlier is exactly right. The US has made a lot of progress. I just don't know how much the American people are able to see that progress. You know, this is stuff that experts see, but I think it's hard to understand if you're sitting in Iowa and, you know, it just doesn't affect you day to day. So bottom line is, I think it's pretty hard for the Biden team to make this argument that they've been the good stewards, just as you said. And as a result, my sense is Biden is going to end up looking sort of old and weak, right? And the best argument for Biden is that he has been a good steward on foreign policy, but that's probably not going to get him a lot of traction, and that the US economy is actually particularly strong, shockingly so. But if you look at the polls, a lot of Americans don't actually think the economy is strong. And so I think this leaves Biden in a really, really tough spot. And it is increasingly hard for me to imagine how he wins without Donald Trump imploding. Now, the chance
that could
of
happen.
Donald Trump, yes, right? You know, I can think of, you know, something like 90 felony counts that Trump is under, which would be a serious implosion. There's a court case which I think is highly unlikely to be successful before the Supreme Court, trying to keep Trump off the ballot because he was involved in an insurrection. But it seems to me that the most likely outcome here is a Trump win. And I think the repercussions on foreign policy would be huge. I'll just mention one before handing it back to you, which is we've heard Robert Lighthizer talk quite openly and apparently with some support from Donald Trump about putting tariffs on every country around the world, right? And that, I mean, this is a far cry from pulling out of TPP. We're now really going backward on trade policy if that's what the Trump administration would try and do if they won later this year. So I think it's going to be a really tough year when it comes to foreign allies, including Japan, watching the United States.
Yeah, two things that might make one a little bit more optimistic if you're a Biden fan, although maybe not much. The first is that we are still at the phase of the race when scrutiny of the Biden administration's miscues is actually greater than scrutiny of Trump and his travails. And once Trump is the nominee, then all of the focus will come back onto what would it mean to have this man be president of the United States again. And I predict that a lot of the sort of mobilization and enthusiasm issues that Biden is having with Democrats will be solved by Donald Trump. Once Donald Trump is on the ballot, a large portion of the Democratic coalition will be very enthusiastic about defeating him, even if they're not particularly enthusiastic about Joe Biden. Second point is that it typically takes time for good objective news about the economy to turn into bullish consumer sentiment, bullish popular views of the economy. And so I think the Biden theory is that, okay, we seem to be sticking the soft landing or close to it. If that happens, you know, Q4 2023, Q1 2024, by, you know, end of Q2 2024, we should be seeing improving consumer sentiment. We'll know whether that is the case soon. And we also know that voter views of the economy tend to get locked in a few months ahead of the election. So we'll actually know kind of by the end of the spring, midsummer, whether Biden is getting this tailwind or not. One thing that makes you feel worse if you worry about a Trump presidency is what I think the overall effect of a Trump presidency will be from the perspective of U.S. partners and allies really around the world. So in a number of respects, Trump, let's say if you are a U.S. ally in Europe or in Asia, under a Trump presidency, you are likely to have very high tensions with your primary security threat, Russia and Europe, China, or North Korea in East Asia, and very high tensions with your primary security provider, which is the United States, mostly along economic issues, but perhaps also if Trump decides to make good on some of his earlier threats to withdraw from alliances or make them more conditional. And I think that's actually the least comfortable position for countries like Japan or South Korea or Germany to be in, because if you're going to have instability on one front, you really want to have stability on the other.
Well, I think this is a great point for us to stick on and maybe end on in a bit, which is, how does this matter? Really, let's just talk about the US and Japan for the last couple of minutes. You know, my concern is very much along the lines of yours. You've got growing challenges if you're Japan, Russia, China, North Korea, and you might have a more challenging alliance partner. And so I think managing that dynamic is going to be incredibly difficult. One thing that you and I did when we were in Japan was we had a chance to go around a little bit to other parts of Japan, including the Southwestern Islands, and take a look at some of the cooperation we're seeing from the two countries and think a little bit about some of the tensions in the U.S.-Japan alliance and more broadly about how to deal with the China challenge. And, you know, do you want to say a couple words about some of that and maybe some of the lessons that we took away? I think there are a lot of things that we learned, but in particular about some of the sort of trade-offs between what the U.S. might want to do in terms of bolstering its defense capabilities, but also the political implications of those efforts.
Well, it's ludicrous for me to pretend to be the expert on U.S.-Japan relations in a conversation with you, but I'll do my best Zach Cooper imitation and try to talk maybe a little bit about sort of what's good, what's challenging in the relationship, particularly the defense relationship, and then connect it to the political issues. And, you know, you'd probably agree with me, Zach, I would think, in saying that, you know, the US and Japan are doing pretty remarkable things when it comes to thinking about Western Pacific defense posture, and whether that's sort of building out the Japanese military presence and some of the outer southwestern islands, or a variety of other things that they're doing together. You're seeing movement on issues that had sort of been talked about for a number of years, but until only recently had you seen progress. I think there are some challenges, though, and so one of the challenges is, you know, if you're thinking about what would actually constitute a meaningful deterrent to, say, Chinese aggression, the military posture, the military capabilities that are taking root in the southwestern islands are still pretty rudimentary compared to the threat. And so you need to build those things out pretty significantly. You need to build out patterns of U.S.-Japan cooperation in and around those islands pretty significantly. And you don't have a ton of time to do so if you accept some of the more concerning estimates of when China might become more aggressive. But there are at least a couple of political challenges that stand in the way, one local and one international. The local political challenge is that often local politics is the governor on how fast you can go in terms of developing a Japanese military presence on some of these islands, let alone a U.S. military presence. And so the concern has to be that the harder you push on these issues, if you're the Pentagon, for instance, the more you risk provoking a backlash from local populations that are still ambivalent about some of the initiatives that are taking shape. But, and let me connect this here to the Trump issue. What this means actually is that it's a really bad time to have friction at sort of the 35,000 foot level part of the political relationship between the US and Japan, because that relationship has been so cohesive under the Biden administration. And that is sort of the necessary precondition to addressing any of these challenges, whether it's about local sentiment, whether it's about thinking about, you know, how the US and Japan might work together on countering gray zone provocations or whatever the case may be. You're only going to get there, I think, if you have a pretty cohesive relationship at the leader to leader level. And that is less likely to be the case if you get President Trump. Now, some might say, well, President Trump and Prime Minister Abe had a pretty good relationship during the first Trump term. Yes, but of course, Abe is no longer with us. And one of the concerns we heard from a number of people in Tokyo is that it's not clear who in the Japanese political system could play that role this time around, whether Prime Minister Kishida or someone else.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And a good place to end on, which is that, you know, the domestic politics in US-Japan alliance actually haven't been a big factor for the last couple of years. But I think in both countries, we could see domestic politics really come to the forefront, right? I mean, we don't know. I'm going to guess that the LDP is going to stay in power for quite a while, but we don't really know at the end of the year who the Japanese prime minister will be. It might be Prime Minister Kishida, it might not be. And in the US, we have no idea, I think, what the outcome of our election will be, but we know it could be a major change. And so, you know, some of the sort of fine tuning of US-Japan issues, I think it's going to feel a bit passe if we get major domestic political changes in one or both countries that force sort of a reassessment about where we're going from here. And maybe just the final word from me would be, at the end of the day, I think the US-Japan alliance is still in a pretty good position, right? We have a shared threat assessment to a pretty high degree about China, a shared view largely about how to deal with most of the key problems in the rest of the world. But the next step of what do you do about these things, you know, it's going to get harder and harder, I think, over 2024 for both countries to be confident that they're going to be able to actually execute a well-aligned strategy over the next few years. And I do worry as a result about not giant fissures in the relationship, but little gaps on small issues. You know, we've seen this a little over Israel-Gaza, for example. And so I think the fear that I have is that we'll start to see some of these gaps open up, and we'll have to do some careful alliance work to keep them under control. Not that we can't do that, but I think it could be a challenge.
The only thing I'll add, Zach, is you and I have been saying, I think for about 3.5, 4 years now, that the U.S.-Japan relationship is the most important alliance relationship the United States has, for reasons of geography, for reasons of military balancing, for technological reasons, and a whole bunch of other reasons. And we really need it firing on all cylinders in the years to come.
Amen. Well, that's a great place to end, Hao. Aya, we'll hand it back to you, but thanks so much for having both of us on.
Well, thank you very much, Hao and Zach. It was a very interesting and thoughtful discussion, I think. While the EU tourist, so many issues and challenges we are going to tackle with this year and learn how it is complicated too. Well, as Zach mentioned briefly at the end, our domestic politics is also not stable. And we may have also like natural disaster again. So those challenges ahead are very difficult. Well, today's discussion was very interesting and a great discussion. And I believe audience really enjoyed and learned from the discussion as well and got many insights to think about the time we are currently living. So the US and Japan and maybe entire world are actually in unprecedented time facing multiple security issues as well as domestic problems. But therefore, we need to continue our discussion to think and look for what we have to do for stable and secure international order. So to do so, our program will do our best in 2024. And I really hope we will be able to host you two again in near future and continue our discussion. So thank you both again for joining us today and look forward to talking to you again in near future. Thank you.
Thanks, Aya.